So nice to have you here today. We appreciate you coming. This really, any of you who've been affected by this, and I'm assuming that that's why you're here, that you've been touched by one of the most insidious forms of what is called psychotherapy to ever hit our world. And we're so troubled because we're seeing innocent families being absolutely shattered and destroyed by people who believe they can read the hearts and minds of others, and they can't. And we're just thankful today to have the Rutherfords here to share with us and to tell us their story. I know it's going to move you. You maybe have heard some of their story, but we're going to just ask that you would be touched and moved. And our church, though I recognize this is not a Christian organization as such, FMS, our church is delighted to have you as our guests here.
Happening, I think that one of the most magnificent statements that we have about the change that has been taking place is the presence of the Rutherford family with us today. I knew about the Rutherford case, oh, I guess several months after they contacted a lawyer named Sid Willens. I don't think I've ever mentioned this to anyone in the family, but I was getting weekly, if not daily, reports from Sid Willens about this family. He said, "You've got to put them on television. You've got to get them in the media." He said, "They are the most remarkable family because of the documentation that they can bring to this effort, because we still live in a very skeptical world, even today. I mean, I can bring you good news, but, you know, we are a couple of years ahead of the world at large. There's a lot of catching up that needs to be done." And I believe that certainly one of the most powerful forces that we have is the willingness of the whole family, the combined forces of a loving family, to give up their privacy, to give up their time, to give up their money, to try to educate professionals who need to be educated, and to try to bring hope to those of you whose families are still torn asunder. I've listened to the Rutherfords now 4 or 5 times, and I am glued at each presentation. I feel sometimes when I'm listening to Shanna, the middle daughter, talk about her experience, that for the very first time I have an understanding of one of my children that I was never able to get from talking with professionals or anyone else. And so I hope that each of you today is able to bring away even half as much as I've been able to get, and maybe you'll get twice as much. But what I would like us all to do is to the Rutherfords, who will tell you in their own words the FMS story. Thank you.
Thank you, Pam. Yes, I didn't know all of that, but I can believe that. Our family couldn't have been really more on course than what it was in 1990 when we moved from Pennsylvania pastoring after 18 years, and one of the hallmarks of our ministry was our family. Our girls were all involved. Matter of fact, one church we pastored, it was so small that Beth was the piano player, Lynette was the organist, Joyce ran the nursery, Shara ran the sound equipment, and you can imagine what happened to that church when we went on vacation. Was like the whole church left, but we loved it there, and that was the kind of family that we had when it came to ministry in the church. We simply loved it and enjoyed it, and those 18 years were probably the most wonderful 18 years of our lives. We had a wonderful family. And we knew from the very start, as the girls were getting older, how much we loved our daughters, and we knew our daughters loved us. Due to, in 1990, to Beth working as a nursing assistant in a hospital on a cancer floor, and she was seeing some of the most grotesque, horrible deaths. Even I've never even seen anything like that or to compare to that ever in all my life. I never knew what a bleed out was, that somebody would literally, before your very eyes, bleed through their ears, their nose, out their mouth, literally drowning in blood and the blood clots and everything that accompany that. And when Beth saw those things, here, a 23-year-old mom with two little boys beside her saying just 2 days earlier, "Mama, when are you going to come home?" And then she died. These kind of things were very, very difficult for Beth. And when she came home, having difficulty sleeping at night, she talked to her mom and me. We decided due to the fact that our church has a counselor who happened to be our pastor's wife, good friends of ours. We had a lot in common. We felt very comfortable to refer and ask if the pastor's wife, who is a graduate with a degree in counseling, that if she would be willing to meet with our daughter, in which she said to us that she would be willing, which made us very, very happy. Little did we realize at the time then when that arrangement was made that Beth would embark upon 2.5 years, the most horrible counseling of age regression therapy or recovery memory therapy. There are other names that accompany that kind of therapy. We did not know it at the time, but for the next 2.5 years, Beth continued to meet with this counselor, sometimes only once a month, and then it began to progress to once a week, to more than 2 or 3 times a week, instead of an hour each session, sometimes 2 and 3 and 4 hour marathons, never realizing any of these things were going on. But after the end of 2.5 years, of which Joyce and I knew nothing, several things were beginning to take place, and it was like a big snowball that really started out at the top of a mountain, very small, but as it began to progress down the mountain slide, it continued to increase in speed and size. When it impacted our family, it seemed as though all of life and reason for living, it was over. You see, early in the summer, when Beth actually was no longer our daughter, we would have never recognized her. She had become a different kind of a person we wouldn't even have recognized. But Beth, at the end of this counseling, she began to allege some of the most horrible, sodomizing atrocities that you could ever possibly imagine. Again, we knew nothing. I was called by our pastor and told that we could no longer participate in any kind of a ministry at our church. I was devastated. When I asked for some kind of an explanation, it was very vague, very nebulous, without any clear explanation. You see, over the next 21 months, I attempted 86 times to bring some kind of a resolution and reconciliation to this thing, of which not a single phone call or a request in writing or a request through a secretary for an appointment, not a single time was there ever a single response, even on a half sheet of paper, acknowledging that either a phone call had been made or a request for an appointment had been made. One of our devastations was, during those 21 months, as we reached out to our church and our church leadership, is that they would intervene and bring reconciliation, but the church refused to deal with the church. During this time, our family, again, Joyce and I not knowing this, shortly after the fact that I had been asked to have no longer any involvement in the church, I was called into our international headquarters where I was employed, to the personnel office, and I was dismissed. A very nebulous, unclear, no explanation, even asked to sign a rehabilitation statement. I said, "What am I being rehabilitated for?" The response was, "This is a matter of procedure. We do this under these circumstances." And there was a long list of information there and additional information, but the fact is, I requested a hearing, of which the hearing was denied. Not knowing any of these things and what it was that we were being accused of up until this point. I was now unemployed. Several more months have passed, and in our denomination, we have church leadership broken down into some kind of a structure of which, when these kinds of things are to be dealt with, they go to a state leadership. And in our particular context, it would be the Southern Missouri district leadership, which was part of our state leadership within the ecclesiastical setting. Early on in 95, Joyce and I were called in for a meeting of which we did not know what it was about. I said to Joyce, kind of in passing on the way over there, "You know what? They might be going to be offering me a job. After all, I've got a Master's of Divinity from a graduate school, 18 years of pastoral experience, And with all the other qualifications, I thought maybe that might be a possibility, which I was really looking forward to this meeting. But when we walked through the door of the conference room, there sat several other ministerial level officials. Joyce and I went in and were seated, and then the district official began to read to us a statement. One of your daughters is alleging that she had been molested over a long period of time growing up in your home. All three of your daughters are alleging that they have been emotionally and physically abused growing up in your home. Joyce and I were absolutely devastated. We couldn't believe it. We actually looked at them and said, there's got to be a mistake. You've got the wrong family. This isn't true. This is not our family. But this sober and a straight-faced, we knew that they were serious. They continue to read. You need to sign a statement of guilt. And if you do not and refuse to sign the statement of guilt, your file in its entirety will be turned over to the district attorney's office to be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. We were absolutely horrified. We found out very soon after that that I, if prosecuted, was facing 7 years to life in prison. This thing ended our lives. Joyce and I sat in that meeting, and honestly, we were literally so overwhelmed. We were but a raw piece of meat riveted to those chairs. We almost had to peel ourselves off of the chair to even be physically able to get up and leave that room. Obviously, we said, there's no guilt, there's no wrong, there's nothing of any sort has ever been committed. There's no truth to these accusations. Please, and I remember Joyce, and by this time she had been weeping, she pleaded with them and said, please, could we talk to our daughters? Let's get a conference call right now, and we'll call our daughters, and we'll let you listen, and they'll tell you, and they'll straighten this whole thing out. But again, just as still and straight-faced, they said to us, as a matter of fact, you need to be aware of the fact that you're not allowed to contact your daughters. And should you try to contact them, and if it can be construed that you are either harassing them or intimidating them in any way, it'll be used in a court of law against you. We didn't know fully at the time, but we were devastated. All we could do when we left that place was weep and cry, hold on to one another, and say, what has happened to our daughters? What is going on? With the next several days, we indeed were informed of the whole charge. You see, we were told, and it was alleged, that I had impregnated Beth 2 times, that I had performed the first painful coat hanger abortion on her, that my wife, and you would have to know my wife to understand what I'm about to say. Because when I first met her, the thing that attracted me to her then, of the marvelous qualities of a godly woman, a kind, compassionate, gentle, loving, caring, that when these charges were laid against her, it was more than I could bear. A mom that had given herself all of these years, never worked outside of the home, but lived for her family and loved her children. There were times when I would come home, you know how it's like in the ministry, you get home late, and Joyce would tuck the girls in bed, and I could see when I come through the door and I'd try to be quiet, all the lights were out and the girls were tucked into bed. And she would be sitting there in the hallway with a flashlight, and she would be singing from one of the hymn books, What a Friend We Have in Jesus, or It Is Well With My Soul, or one of those other great hymns of the church. And she would be singing. Instead of just pushing them off the bed, she'd tuck them into bed. You know, she literally read the New Testament from cover to cover for the girls several times as they were growing up, tucking them into bed at night. She spent time sewing with them and making pajamas with them and cake decorating and so many wonderful things. But when we were told in this meeting that my wife restrained my daughter while I violated her, It was like an atomic explosion going off in my mind. There were times when our head hit the pillow at night, and honestly, we prayed, God, it would be more merciful of us if you would let us die than to ever live another day. You see, as age regression and this kind of stuff goes, again, one of the tenets of that stuff is the only way you're ever going to get better is if you separate yourself from your parents or from the perpetrator. At the time, and understanding, and as the months progressed, we honestly came to believe that aside from a miracle of the Lord, there is only one way we will ever see our daughters. Outside of a miracle from the Lord, we will likely never see our daughters again in our lifetime. Our lives were literally smashed. We were living in a living emotional torture. It was as though we were in a hole of some sort and living in battery acid every waking moment of our day. And it was literally eating at every fiber of our being. There were times when Joyce and I looked at our lives. We didn't want to go on. Honestly, we wanted to sell our home, and we put it up on the market for sale. And we wanted to move to the most remote part on the face of the earth and live in obscurity for the rest of our lives. There were those times where we felt that if we could just simply separate ourselves and put several thousand miles between us and our children, we could have enough strength to go on for another 24 hours. There were times where we actually said, I think I can make it for 24 more hours. And you see, we're really not here to tell our story. But we are going to attempt to share with you some of the things that we've learned as a family. And we are hoping that if we can simply help one family, it makes it worth it all. There were times when Joyce and I, in the wee hours of the morning, when we'd get alone with God, and I would remember crying out to God and saying, God, don't let this pain be in vain. Make something good come from it, if that is ever possible. We don't have all the answers. I'm not even sure that we have part of the answers. We are learning as we move along. I know that I am in an audience that everybody would agree that there is the violation of children sexually in this land, and it is appalling, it is outrageous, and in no way is their punishment adequate and sufficient enough for somebody that would ever sexually molest a child. But I also feel that there is nothing more egregious that could ever be done, and that is to be falsely accused of molesting a child, especially by a loving, innocent parent. I think, I bet you were thinking, I was hoping he would eventually get to that. I'd like you to look at question number one, and that is, I'm going to take just a moment to share with you a little, nothing more than a snapshot picture of regressionism and recovered memory therapy. I think one of the issues regarding regressionism is that it is the greatest mental health issue of our time. It comes under several different kinds of names, but it is a despicable, horrible therapy without any regard for the family. We feel that something must be done about this absurd, misguided. Those who are counselors, therapists, psychologists, who walk into the life of a family and bring total devastation and ruin. I ask, is there something wrong when a member of the family walks into therapy because of maybe job stress or something else related, and after several months or perhaps after several years, a once strong, happy, healthy family, after this therapy, is shredded and torn to pieces? Is that good therapy? You see, regressionism, and there are a number of books out on the subject, has little regard for the family whatsoever. So regardless of what has brought the person to therapy, if it's depression, an eating disorder, school difficulties, perhaps job stress, there are some underpinnings on the part of the therapist and what they hold to and believe in. one of which is, in their thinking, the underlying cause of all problems of abuse or of this kind of a trauma or any kind of thing that brought you to therapy, it's abuse. And their next step, which is nudged forward, I think, in time, is that there is one kind of abuse. Ultimately, they point to sexual abuse. And the only way of recovery or healing, we must go back to your past, dig up the past, identify those perpetrators, and then confront the perpetrators. If the abuser doesn't acknowledge his vile acts, then they and all who stand with him or her are in denial, and we must separate ourselves from them or we'll never get better. One of the underpinnings of their tenets, no need for corroboration or external verification. Little consideration whatsoever for fact or logic. They say healing's going to take over a number of years, perhaps a lifetime. Your parents, you see, are considered guilty because why would anybody make such a claim if it wasn't true? You need to abandon your family. And on it goes. I'm glad, and neither could I stomach making this day a day of acquainting you with their thinking. One of the questions asked, and Beth's going to come and try to share her own personal experience of how did this happen? How could you walk in and in a matter of 2.5 years later, when indeed she was a virgin and still is, how could you believe these atrocities indeed? And she did believe that it all had happened. I love you, Beth, and I'm so proud of you.
Okay. Can you hear me all right? I can't really.
How about this? There we go. I can hear that. I'm going to start out here for the first part explaining how this actually happened, how I came to believe this, and then in the second half I'll be coming and talking about what it was that got myself turned around and coming back home. What were some of the things my mom and dad did that helped me? What some of the things, if they had done, would have just driven me further away, that kind of thing. But I'd like to take the first part of time that I have here to explain how did this happen. I have people ask me, you know, did you really believe that this happened to you? You know, was there always some kind of doubt in the back of your mind that you kind of knew it didn't? And at first, yes, there was doubt in my mind, but by the time I was done therapy, and actually about halfway through, I did 100% believe this had happened to me. Nobody could have told me different. And I was convinced, and I'll go through that process of how I even got to that point. As my dad had mentioned, I was working on a cancer floor and was having problems with the trauma that I would see there. At 19 years old, death and dying is not your focus of life. And I made the appointment, and I had two very good sessions with my counselor, the therapist, and I felt very helped. You know, my focus was turned away from the death and the dying part and more into ministry and how to help these people in their last few days, moments, what have you, of life. And I felt very good from that. And at the end of a second session, we had 15 minutes to kill, so to speak, and did we ever do killing in that time? You know, she asked me, is there anything else I wanted to talk about? And I said, no, you know, I think this wraps it up. I'm feeling great. I think I got a new focus on this, and I'm done. And she said, well, you know, these are your 15 minutes if you have anything you want to talk about. And I said, well, you know, I do have these really weird, strange dreams about my dad and I. I said, I have dreams where we just holler and scream at each other, and I've never had a relationship like with my father like that. We've never hollered at each other. And it just always puzzled me why I dreamt like that. I'd have dreams of him coming after me with a knife, of sending a bear after me, coming after me with chainsaws. And it just bothered me because we don't have a violent family of why that would be. And she said to me, well, have you ever been sexually abused? And I said, no, you know, that's never happened to me. You know, and she said, well, is there, you know, been anybody, either a relative, neighbor, a friend, a teacher, or anything like that, that's ever done anything to you? I said, no. And she asked me that like two or three more times, and I couldn't figure it out, why is she asking me? So I asked her, I said, why are you asking me this? And she said to me, well, people who are sexually abused dream the kind of dreams you're dreaming. And because you dream those dreams, it's indicative that you've been abused as a child. And by that time, our 15 minutes was kind of up, and she said to me, I want you to go home, and I want you to think about something, you know, something in your past. See if you can remember anything having happened to you. And so then, you know, that was the end of that, and I went home, and over those 3 weeks went by, and I mean, there was just nothing there. I knew that. So I decided I've got to make an appointment because I don't want anything in her mind that would suspect my father anytime she would see him of thinking that he had done something to me. I wanted to get this cleared up. So I made the follow-up appointment, and I regret that very much so. And in that next appointment, was the beginning of my journey of 2.5 years of therapy, where I was, my whole life went downhill and spiraled downhill. If you take that half sheet of paper, that process word, I was sitting in a garage getting my oil changed in my car, and I knew these conferences for our family were coming up, and I thought, how can I explain to people how this happens? I had never had a history of any kind of psychological problems. I'd never seen a psychiatrist. The most closest I'd gotten to it was a school counselor to try to decide how to make my, you know, what classes to attend. That's as close as I'd gotten. And, you know, I had never had a history of eating disorder, you know, nothing like that. So I thought, how can I explain how this can happen to a person? And so I sat with a pen and a piece of paper, wrote diagonally across and that kind of thing, and this process thing came out of that time. The first step, well, let's just take the word process itself. It is slow, and you don't realize what's happening to you. For me, it was over 2.5 years. Some people are in therapy longer than that, some a little shorter. But it was slowly that it happened. I didn't realize what was happening to me. Never at any point in my time of therapy did I stop and look back and go, boy, you know, I don't remember this before I came in these doors, and look where I am now. That never entered my mind. But the first step there was the P, was putting doubt in my mind. And it is amazing the power of suggestion of what that can do. I remember my sister in nursing school, her class, there was a girl who was late, and they said to her, hey, listen, when she comes in, just intermittently throughout the day, tell her, you know, do you look okay? Are you feeling all right today? You know, are you sure? You look a little pale today, that kind of thing. Do you know by the end of that class, she went home not feeling well? The power of suggestion is something, you know, somebody can tell, boy, that color doesn't look good, too good on you, and you can probably just about guarantee when you'd put that outfit on, you'd wonder if you should be wearing it. But that, putting that doubt in my mind, and here's some of the things that she said to me. Number one, I enjoyed the academics, and it kind of easier for me, and I was a 4.0 student, and I was told that I was a high-grade achiever because I absorbed myself in academics in order to deal with what was going on at home as a child, and that my 4.0 average was because of that is what I used as an escape as a child. And I remember saying to her, well, I don't even remember anything happening to me. And she said, that's okay, that's normal. You, as a child, would have repressed that because that's the only way you could deal with that. And that now as an adult, that you're older and you're more mature, your mind is going to allow these memories to come forth because now you can handle them as an adult, whereas a child can't. I know my daddy taught a Sunday school class, and sometimes the class would get out late at church, and she told me that the fact that class got out late was the fact that my father was a controlling person, and he didn't want anybody to get into the morning worship service. He wanted them in his class. And, you know, I look back now and go, what was wrong, you know, with me? Why don't I tell that lady where it's at and get out of there? But it's amazing. As she was the professional, I'm not. She's the one with the answers. I was trusted her. She was a trusted friend of our family that I sat and I listened to that. And I, you know, you start to wonder, well, I guess she's saying it's possible to suppress something or repress something like that. Well, maybe it could have happened. You know, I mentioned to her, my father would never do anything. I talked about his character as a dad. And she said to me, well, do you know most abusers hide behind a character that would prevent people from suspecting this? I mean, anything I came out with, she had an answer for it all. The next step we kind of, or phase we went into was that R part, remembering back to your childhood. I didn't know this at the time, but by discussing, I discussed houses, where the bedrooms were, you know, the basement, how the curtains hung, what color the rooms were, you know, those kind of things with her. I didn't know at the time, but actually by telling her those kind of things, it gave her something to weave memories into. And when you get something, for example, that one of the homes we were in was a shed in the backyard, and that actually became a place where I believe that my father had tied me up and tied my legs apart and put a curling iron and a meat fork inside of me. But by taking something that was real to me, that I did know for sure of a shed and that we grew up with, and putting a memory into that, it makes it much more believable when it is real places and real time in your life. The next phase we kind of went into then, and again, this was over 2.5 years of therapy, was beginning to omit the good in my family and in my childhood and focus on this perceived bad. You know, over time, we talked less and less, and then finally not any more of anything good in my family. I can remember at times bringing up something good. Well, what about this? And I was told, no, we need to get focused back over here. So the good was never allowed to be discussed, finally, over time. Let me give you some examples of something that would be good, and that's taken, twisted, and made bad. One thing, my dad and I, when we were growing up, sometimes during the month, he would let me write out the checks for the bills at our home. And I loved that. As a little girl, I felt like such an adult to write out the checks. And of course, he'd sign his name to them, but you know, I felt like a real adult doing this. And instead of the good of that, in that a father teaching his daughter about finances and budget, and how my mom and dad had set that up and how they ran their budget, that was taken and twisted in that my therapist said that my father was giving me a wifely role because only a husband and a wife would run the finances of a home. And for him to allow me to do that meant he preferred me over my mother to pay the bills and run the finances of our home. Again, everything taken and twisted. Another thing being, again, as I've said, the academics came a little bit easier to me. My mom and dad always encouraged me to do good in school. And that instead of a good thing of parental support of a natural tendency a child may have or encouragement for them in school, that was taken and twisted in that my parents encouraged me, of course that was later changing to even pressured me, but encouraged me to do good because if I did good in school, they wouldn't feel guilty about what they were doing to me at home. They wouldn't feel like they were wrecking my life. And that's why they encouraged me to do good in anything. I remember, of course, growing up in the ministry, my mom and dad would leave for conferences sometimes, a ministerial kind of conference. And at times, it was sometimes a week, 2 weeks. And as they would be leaving and giving a hug out the door, I remember my dad giving me a quick peck on the lips as he left. Well, you can imagine how that was taken and turned into something sexual and my dad's desire for me as he was leaving and that kind of thing. Every good thing, it was taken. It didn't matter. I mean, I could be here giving example after example of how that was done. At that point in time, you know, I began to believe that I had been a victim of sexual inappropriateness and not so much abuse. It's just, boy, some things went on in my family that probably just shouldn't have gone on. You know, my father probably should have never given me a kiss goodbye. You know, things like the basement, of course, talking about the basement, and I described it as dark. Now, what basement isn't dark? It's underneath the ground, okay? And the rest of our house had lights and windows, but that wasn't focused on. It was the fact that our house was dark, and it was a dark basement, and, oh, we dwelt on the dark basement. and everything, the dark, gloomy, whatever, was the part that was focused on. The next phase, then, that kind of occurred was the C there, the commitment that dreams and ideas are really true memories and flashbacks. At this point, I was given a lot of books to read about sexual abused children, about their stories, about what happened to them. We spent a lot of time talking about that kind of thing because at that point I still wasn't remembering anything having happened to me by way of a sexual abuse event. But spending that much time and focus on that kind of a subject and taking home books and reading it, that kind of thing, I dream a lot. I had two dreams I was just telling my mom and dad about this morning, last night. I just dream a lot. And consequently, spending that much time on that kind of content, I began to dream about being raped or sexually abused and that kind of thing. And I was told, you know, one of the big things was to come into therapy and tell what kind of dreams you had had that week. And I was told, no, those are not dreams. They are really flashbacks. They are really times in your mind that that's trying to come out, a memory's trying to come out, and that she would help me get these horrible things out of my memory. Also, at this time, hypnosis and trance-like events began to happen. We had a person, her name is Margaret Singer, from California. She reviewed the file in preparation for our lawsuit. She said what actually happened is it's called naturalistic trance induction. It's something that can happen and you don't even know it's happening. To this day, I don't have any conscious recollection of what happened in those time periods. I can remember looking at a clock and the next time coming to, an hour had gone by and I have no idea what happened in that hour there. But at the end of those times, you know, I knew something had happened, like where's the last hour of my life just gone, but I didn't know I had been put under in a trance hypnosis-like state. And when I would come to, she would have a piece of paper and she would read to me what she said I just told her. And they would be events of abuse. You know, your mother came, she took you to your parents' bedroom, and your father violated you, that kind of thing. She'd read it to me. And, you know, there were times it so shocked me, so to speak, and I felt so stunned. You almost feel like a zombie. I don't know if any of you have actually personally witnessed an accident, but what that's like, you just kind of hardly move or talk. That's kind of what it was like for me. And there were times I had to tell her to quit, to stop reading. It was too much. But I, you know, in my mind, I thought she would never lie to me about something like this. Obviously, I have told her that these things happened to me. She says I've told her that these things have happened to me. And so she wouldn't be lying. She's the, you know, again, the professional here. At that point in time, also we kind of went to the next phase there, and that was emotionalizing the memories. At this point, I began to have what you call our body memories, and that makes it very real. I actually could feel it happening to me. For example, when I, you know, would come out of a trance, and it would be a time where my dad had tied my legs up, I could, my legs were actually numb from the ropes. I could actually feel, you know, a meat fork being put inside of me. I could actually feel the pain. Sometimes it was so painful, I couldn't even stand up for a while till that pain would subside. Feeling it happening to you is very reinforcing that this had to have happened to you, because why would I feel it if it never happened? That was very reinforcing to me, and I was about 98% bought into the fact that this had happened to me. It was that point then that I was taken and had psychological testing done. I was seen by a clinical psychologist and two psychiatrists, and I had went through a bunch of psychological tests. And you know, my therapist told me, well, Beth, because I had that 2%, oh man, I just can't believe this happened to me. And she said, well, let's do the testing and I'll let the testing prove to you that it had happened. And that I was, you know, like I said, I was seen by the psychologist and the two psychiatrists, and the testing came back that, yes, I had suffered severe, traumatic, torturous childhood. And I look back now, and I wish I had realized this then, but that a psychological test is not a proof of history. It's not a proof of your childhood events. All it is a reflection of your mind and what you're thinking and what's in your mind. You know, if I... just because I believe that George Washington was the first president of the United States and my test shows that, doesn't mean it actually proves, yes, he was the first president of the United States, just as if I believe that George Washington, the president of the United States, came and visited me when I was born. Just because my test says that doesn't mean it actually happened. A psychological test is only a reflection of what's in your mind or your thinking processes. But I took that test, and that's when I 100% bought into it, because there's no way a clinical psychologist and two psychiatrists and my counselor could all say this happened, and I've had testing to prove that, yes, it had to have happened. And that's when I 100% bought into this, that, yes, this happened to me. And I embraced it wholly that this had happened. We also, part of emotionalizing the memories, spent a lot of time on what a victim feels like. We talked about helplessness and fear and the anger of the helplessness. And if I wasn't angry enough, we did anger therapy and spent a lot of time just really internalizing, you know, more what was in my mind, but internalizing it here. And I look back now, you know, it'd be like injecting somebody with HIV and then giving them the test for AIDS instead of doing it way before at the beginning. Another phase then after I 100% bought into this was then I began to establish loyalty to her and to my therapist. I told her everything, any dinner conversation we had, and you can imagine as a parent, sometimes, you know, some of the comments that would come out, and of course I drug that to the therapist's office. I remember one time, you know, my dad making a comment, we were going to church, and he said, "Boy, Beth, you look really nice today." Well, you can imagine what we did with that one in her office, and it was turned into, "Boy, Beth, you look really nice today." You know, I mean, everything is so exaggerated, and he makes that comment innocently as a dad that he was glad to see his daughter in a dress that day and makes that innocently, but you can see how that was taken and just turned into something totally different. I remember when my dad was dismissed from his job, I went into his office and got the rehabilitation paper he had to sign, and I brought it to my therapist and let her copy it. You know, my loyalties to home were severed, and it became to her. I lived for my therapy, and I lived for my therapy sessions. If I could just make it to Monday morning at 10 o'clock, I'd be okay. And I just lived for therapy. The next part then was the first S there, separating from my parents and anybody who didn't believe my accusations. I was told that the only way I was going to be mentally healthy as an adult would be to get away from my parents. They were likened to me like a cancer, and I've got to cut them out of my life. If I didn't, I would in turn abuse my children, and I had to be the one to break this cycle of abuse. And I didn't want to abuse my children whenever it come along someday, and so that was a motivating factor, that I didn't want to be like my parents. You know, that they were, I was told they're the source of any kind of problem in my life, and by getting away from them, I would then be able to be healthy. At that point in time, I had deteriorated very much physically. I was down 87 pounds. I'd already been in a psychiatric hospital and hospitalized. I was on medication, and I didn't want that kind of a life for myself. I knew I was dying, but I was told the only way I'm going to get out of that is to get away from my parents. And really, it was the therapy that was deteriorating me and making me physically, you know, sick and that kind of thing. But I was told that it was really my parents. And and sometimes, you know, you'll notice with your children, if you hear what they're accusing, it gets worse and worse, and the memories get more and more bizarre. And that's because you begin to deteriorate physically, and you're told that the reason you're not getting better is because you haven't reached the bottom of the memories yet. And they just keep getting worse, and of course you start getting worse, and it's just a cycle. You get worse, well, there's more, and we dig up more, and now you're worse. And, you know, it's just an endless cycle. But me separating from my mom and dad at that point in time, I ended up moving to Oklahoma City from Springfield, and that was the best thing I could have ever done because I got away from her and got away from the therapist and her constant twisting of everything in my life. The separation for me, I did feel good about that in that it erased any kind of emotional conflict I had. You know, anytime I saw my parents, it's like this mental, and I can't even describe it, the tug of war that goes on. And by getting away from them, it's like if you don't see it, you don't have to deal with it. And getting away from them helped or enabled me to not have to face any kind of a reality, so to speak, check. Because my parents were loving, and that didn't necessarily go with what I was believing about them. So to get away from that made it a lot easier. And I think that's why a lot of, if that is not the reason why a lot of children separate from their parents. Then the last step there was the stepization and confrontation. Not every person who's been in this therapy does that. Some people just get away and you just never hear from them again. For some parents, the child doesn't even know that they know what's going on. But in my case, father was accused before the district hearing there, and I did not want to do that. My goal was to just get away, but I was told I either had to accuse him in an ecclesiastical hearing or I had to go to the district attorney. And so I decided I'd probably have more control over the events if I went to an ecclesiastical hearing. And I was promised that I would feel such great freedom after confronting him. And in a desire to have freedom from this mental And it's literally a hell that you're in. I did go ahead then with the confrontation of my parents. Getting out of this is almost the same process, just in reverse, and I'll be explaining that in a little bit. You know, it was seeing my parents again and beginning to remember the good in my childhood and not taking and twisting things and that kind of thing. But I'll be sharing about that a little bit later. Shara is going to come, and she's going to talk about how, as a sibling, she got drawn into this and accused my parents also, and the mental tug of war and what her life was like at that time, too.
I just know I'm going to fall down these stairs. After listening to Beth, the majority of you perhaps have a better idea of how this could happen, and it does happen by a process. As a sibling, I and my sister Lynette went through much the same process, but on a smaller scale and a shorter period of time. After being informed of what my sister was accusing my parents of, me and Lynette were roommates in college, and we were just numb for days. We couldn't eat, we couldn't sleep. We shared some classes together, and we couldn't go. We'd go to class, and we'd sit down, we'd just burst into tears and have to leave. And we just did that for days, asking ourselves, you know, how could we have grown up in this loving home and have grown up with Beth and never have noticed or recognized something like this happening? And, you know, how could my parents do something like this? Because Beth would never, ever lie about this, and she certainly would never intentionally rip our family apart. We were invited to meet with the therapist as a guest of Beth. Perhaps we hoped to find answers to our problems, and this was a really big mistake. She took us through this same process slowly over the course of the afternoon. And Beth, having put the doubt in our mind, she also took parts of our past and our childhood memories, and she twisted them and she ripped them apart, and we were left with disgusting thoughts of anything that represented our family, love, the trust we had, and happiness. After several meetings with the therapist, we learned what was expected of us. Beth was a fragile 87 pounds, and she was dying. She had been admitted to the hospital due to her condition, and we were also shown these reports and the psychologist and psychiatrist reports saying that she had endured a torturous childhood. I loved my sister, and knowing that was just unbearable for Lynette and I. And my sister was dying before my very eyes, and my parents seemed to be standing by doing nothing about it, and to me, they were the ones killing her. And I supported Beth unquestioningly. We were told to do that, and unconditionally as well, or she would die. Lynette gave up everything and went to Oklahoma City to live with Beth to get her away from my parents. We both gave up parents, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins, close family friends, and anyone who didn't believe us. We just severed them from our lives. One evening, my sisters and I and the therapist were sitting around, and I made the comment to Beth. I said, "Beth, you know, what about us?" And that was the last time I ever questioned Beth. The therapist stated to me, "Your sister has given up so much for you. She has taken years of physical, mental, and sexual abuse for you. She has given herself to your father so your father would leave you alone. And the least you can do now is to give something back to her and support her and to not think of yourselves. And if you don't support Beth, she'll die. And if she doesn't die, she would not be able to survive on her own, and she would give up and give in and return to the abusive situation and remain a victim for the rest of her life." And I supported her, and I supported her with all of my heart, and Lynette did as well, for a while. I requested numerous times to confront my parents. I wanted them to say to my face that they either did or did not do this. And we were put off. I was told that Beth was not well enough. She couldn't handle a confrontation. It would drive her away. You can do it later, but not now. The time will come. It's not at the moment. And so we waited, and months went by. We were separated from each other. The girls went to Oklahoma City, and I went back to school to attempt another semester. And the good part of that was they got away from the therapist, and that's a really big step. I was struggling my second semester of college. I moved to a room by myself to hide from my parents, afraid that they would come and kill me. I couldn't attend classes. I kept skipping, and I was sinking slowly into very serious depression. I was rebelling against anything that my parents had ever taught me was good. I body pierced. I did drugs, and I was drinking a lot. And there were weeks at a time where I'd come in, and I would never be sober. I wrote down all the things that were stressing me out, and there were 23 things on that list. My sisters were gone. We were separated from each other. They were all I had. I was sick for the third time in a month due to stress, and I couldn't work. I was left with a few cents left to my name. School was ending, and I certainly could not return home, and I had pushed all of my friends away. And so I had nowhere to go, and I was pretty much a homeless person at 18 years of age. I was doing so poorly in school that my cumulative GPA was a 0.31, 1.0 being a D. And I had no parents, and I had no family. And I had no reason to go on. And I sat that night with a bottle of sleeping pills in the hope of falling asleep and never waking up. And I cried out to God that night and asked if he could see me, if there was a reason for me to go on or for me to live, that he would send me some sign. And a friend of mine called at 3:00 in the morning from California, and he did nothing but talk about himself, but it seemed to jerk me back to reality. And I think one of the reasons I decided to go on was to, in the end, get back at my parents and prove that they were wrong. I called the therapist the next morning to tell her that my life is just falling to pieces and I can't live like this anymore. My life is a mess. I can't go to school. I'm stressed out. I'm depressed. I'm sick. And I need some drastic measures to get things back together. And I said, you know, when does the family come back together? You've promised that after we come out and accuse my parents and take these steps that, you know, eventually the family will get back together and healing will come, and it's not happening. And she gave me a grief cycle chart, and she told me where I was stuck on it. And for those of you that don't know what that is, it's a cycle of denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance, and eventually, if you ever get there, forgiveness. And she said I was stuck somewhere in between denial and depression, and I would bounce back and forth for a while. And she said to me, and I quote, "You won't be ready for forgiveness for at least 2 to 3 more years." And I guess that meant I was supposed to be depressed and angry for a little while longer. I guess the biggest questions my parents are asked is, how on earth can you keep love for children after they've done something like this to you? And my mom's going to come and share.
You're getting the full scope. Beth's, what's going on in her heart and life at this time, then the siblings, her sisters, and then the parents. Your lives are blown apart, and we shared a lot of that at the conferences the last couple of days. Question number 5, how do you not lose love for your child in the midst of these kind of accusations and Holocaust? and some things that helped me or helped us not to lose love. Number one, focusing on things like, I am committed to them by birth. I gave birth to them. They are mine. They look like me. I've always loved them. I will always love them. I'll always care, regardless of the mistakes or what life brings. My desire as a mom was to enjoy and love my children, and I'm committed to them from birth. The next thing, how do you not lose love? By reaffirming all the good. We had years of wonderful memories. I mean, we've got a closet at home that is stacked from floor up with hundreds and hundreds of slides of fun. Wonderful times, picnics, vacations, raking leaves, baking cookies, raising puppies, ice skating. I know who they are, and I know who we are. I know the investment, the sacrifice. I know how the girls were raised, and I won't let the bad of what's happening now overpower and overshadow and annihilate all those good years and all those good memories. How do you not lose love? Number three, focus on the real culprit of the nightmare. And it's not your son or daughter who at a time of vulnerability goes into somebody, a professional, for help in dealing and walking through this. They trusted a professional and got sucked into something that they didn't know was there. The real culprit of this stuff is the therapist, counselor. Sometimes it's even a book or a seminar that some have gotten lured into this stuff. The real culprit is the therapy, the ideas, techniques, the philosophy that mentally and emotionally dismantles a person. It's like a hidden bear trap that your child gets caught in. There's a tendency to reject them and cut them off. You know, what you've done to me, that's it. But as a parent, when you see them getting caught in a trap, you know, rather than how could you ever get caught in that? Well, they never saw it to begin with. Instead of seeing the real culprit as being the person setting the traps or the traps themselves destroying innocent people. Another way to not lose love for your child, by praying for your son or daughter. For me, and I'm just sharing things that help me. You can't hate somebody and pray for them too. There's a book in the Bible called Lamentations, and it means, the meaning to that word is weeping. Well, I never enjoyed that book at all. I thought it was such a depressing book. I never got anything out of it till this happened. And all of a sudden I could identify so fully with those scriptures. And let me just read a couple to you that meant so much to me. It says, this is why I weep and my eyes overflow with tears. No one is near to comfort me, no one to restore my spirit. My children are destitute because the enemy has prevailed. Chapter 2 of Lamentations says, those I cared for and reared, my enemy has destroyed. Pour out your heart like water in the presence of the Lord. Lift up your hands to Him for the lives of your children. Do you feel like your situation is hopeless, like your son or daughter has been gone too long? There is nothing that will ever turn them around. And that may be true, and God will not overpower a person's, because He's given us free choice, He'll not overpower their choice. But I am convinced that God, if anybody can, God knows how to get through to that heart and that spirit of that person, of your son or daughter. And if He can't do it, nobody can. And so we prayed for the girls. And you can't hate somebody that you're praying for. The next thing, how to not lose love, keep looking for opportunities to show love, to reach out and to rescue them. It's kind of like them being caught in a burning building and you're on the ground and you have a ladder in your hand. Would you not use your ladder to try to save them? And we looked for opportunities to show love, and you never know when that may come. a call, a gift, a smile, or maybe just a gentle answer. And I know some of you have had contact with your sons or daughters, and they are hostile, they are bitter, and their words cut like knives. And I remember a particular time that Shara called home, and she had wanted her birth certificate and all her official documents, because when she left home, she didn't have any of that, and she wanted those from us. And she called, and she was very rebellious, bitter, hostile, and she was very rude. And she said cutting words to me. And my immediate response was hurt. I was crushed. She has never talked to me like that. And after all we've been through. And then after, right behind that feeling of being so crushed and rejected, came a feeling of anger. How dare you talk to me like that? After all we've been through and all I've ever done is loved and nurtured you, how dare you talk to me like that? But I bit my tongue and I answered her back gently. There was a little bit of silence there. And I answered her back gently and then hung up the phone and cried. I was crushed. And it wasn't until after we got back as a family that she told her side of that story. Do you know she got off the phone and cried? And she said to the person with her, I have never talked to my mother that way. But little did I know, I saw it as a horrible experience, and all I felt was the rejection. But there was a part that was getting to her because of my response to her. Looking for an opportunity to show love. A horrible tragedy in our country, the Oklahoma City bombing, a nightmare for all those who live in that city. I have two daughters that were there when that bombing happened. And I was working at the hospital that day, going in and out of patients' rooms, and on the TV I heard the news. And everybody, of course, immediately, you know, when a tragedy happens, you know how you bind together, and it was the talk of everybody. And nurses at the hospital that knew Beth, because she had worked at the hospital too, started asking me, how is Beth? Is she all right? Have you heard anything? And how are you going to tell these people, no, I'm not allowed to talk to my daughter. I have no idea whether she's living or dead. And all that worked on my mind the rest of the day. Well, I got home from work, and I'm not supposed to have any contact with them, according to the system and the instructions. And I thought to myself, I have got to know about my daughters. I've got to know. And if they want to lock me up because I care and because I love my girls, then let them lock me up. But I'm calling. So I got on the phone and I got their answering machine. And I just left a message on the answering machine. And I said, Beth and Lynette, this is your mom. And I heard about the bombing today at work. And I knew that they both worked down by that bombing. And I said, I just have to know if you're all right. If you'll just let me know that you're okay. I just need to know that. And if there's anything you need, if you're lacking anything, if there's anything we can do, you know we're right here. And we'll help you in any way we can. And then I just hung up. To my utter shock, in about an hour or two, Beth called me. And this was the first contact. And she was kind of cool, but she said, Mom, I'm just calling. I wanted to let you know we're okay. And I really can't talk right now, and goodbye. And it, just real short and sweet. But at least I knew they were alive. And then this is a few hours later into the night, about maybe three more hours went by, she called again. Picked up the phone, and it's Beth again. And she says, I just wanted to call, and I couldn't talk earlier, but I wanted to let you know we were okay. And so we chit-chatted for a few minutes. It seemed like a wonderful few minutes. I asked her about the traffic. Were you getting a lot of patients in the hospital? You know, are you seeing any influx because of the tragedy? And we talked about how it was affecting them, and she talked about her sister where she worked, how the roof was lifted off their building, but she was okay. And then all of a sudden I think she felt she was talking too much. So she quick said, well, I gotta go, and we hung up again. But what a breakthrough. Just looking for an opportunity to show love. And you know, when something goes wrong, like a tragedy like that, how many of you know and have felt, I want my mom? And I think that was the feeling that day when they called. Another way to not lose love is just trying to hang on to the hope that someday they'll come home, and being there and be ready when they are. It's kind of like the father and the prodigal son, just when they're ready and in time, be ready. Question number 6 is, how do you forgive a child for doing this, making false accusations like this, ruining your life, the pain, the humiliation, the devastation? And again, I go back to that thought. Number 1, understand that they're not responsible for a malpracticing professional. They are no more responsible than a patient who submits to a surgery, trusts like a physician or a surgeon, who cuts off the wrong patient's leg. And how many of us would tolerate that? And in this case, for us, it was a 19, 20, 21-year-old. For you, it may be a 39, 49, 59-year-old daughter that goes into therapy, whatever the case. When you understand this kind of therapy, the hidden agenda, and how this works, it's no different than the brainwashing techniques that they used to use during the war. Understand that this is not your daughter. This is not your son. They aren't acting like themselves and who you know them to be and who they were. They're caught in a death trap, and they're simply parroting the brainwashing. How do you forgive a child for doing this? And in focusing, like on the sisters, there came a point when I said, okay, Beth has been through the therapy and she's been destroyed by this. But how in the world could the sisters believe this? They haven't been through the therapy. They grew up in our home. They know us. How in the world could people who haven't been through this therapy believe this? And I had a hard time dealing with forgiveness for them. Till one day, Tom helped me out by giving me a scenario, and I want to do this with you. I want you to think of somebody in your family right now who is the most trusted, highly respected, loved, honest, sensible one out of your whole family, your extended family, you know, immediate family. And hopefully you have somebody like that in your family. Think of the most sensible one you have. And Tom did this to me. He said, Joyce, if your sister came to you, and mind you, I love my sister, and there's somebody here today that knows my sister. She is as level-headed and as wonderful. I highly respect her and love her. But do you know what? If my sister came to me and she said to me, Joyce, you know, I never told you this because I never wanted to hurt you or our family, but when we were little, our dad molested me. He did something horrible to me. Do you know I would have the tendency to believe her? Because I know my sister. She would never lie. She'd never make that up, and she'd never destroy me or my family with that kind of a story. And I realized how vulnerable I was to believe a story like that. And if I could do it with my sister, I can easily see how they would do it with theirs. And it gave me a whole understanding of perspective that I didn't have before. I was susceptible to believe something because I trusted the person. The next thing, how can I forgive? When I look at all the intelligent adults, the church leaders, and the psychological professionals that were involved in our case, and they participated, they were all duped by a trusted position and the credibility of a therapist. And none of them questioned the techniques or practices or picked up on it. How can I expect a vulnerable daughter that she was supposed to see through all this when nobody else does? How can I forgive? All I have to do is think of myself. You know, I'm not perfect. I want and I'm in need of other people's forgiveness. I'm in need of God's forgiveness for the mistakes I've made. And if the God of this universe, who is so incomprehensibly big and he's perfect, yet he's willing to extend and reach out in love and forgive me for the mistakes, the sins, the shortcomings, the errors that I've made. And all I have to do is ask. And he's willing to take an imperfect, tiny person like me and let me into his big heaven. I say to myself, what's the big deal? Shouldn't I extend that same kind of love and forgiveness to other struggling people? And about this time that I was going and dealing with this thing of forgiveness, it's like I can't, they've ruined us, you know, and focusing on all those things. Tom and I took a trip and we were in an airplane. And you, all of you that fly, you get up there so high and you look down. And the Lord used this experience to help me deal with this. And I looked down out of that airplane window and I saw all the little houses and I saw little tiny cars buzzing down the road. And in those little tiny cars, if you look really close, you can see little itty bitty people that fit in the little tiny cars. And I looked and I thought about that. I thought, little itty bitty people, they barely look like a grain of sand from up here. How much damage can little itty bitty people do to each other? And I thought, if God, who's so big, can forgive me, why can't I forgive other little itty-bitty people that are struggling like I am to get through this life and get on to heaven? And for you, maybe that doesn't mean anything to you. For me, that helped me over the hump. I can forgive. Life is so short. We're only here a little while. And sometimes when I would think it's too big, it's too deep, I would say, Lord, I can't. But if you'll help me, if you'll help me deal with the inside, I'm willing to have you work on me. And he has never failed when I meant it to work on me. In closing, I ask myself, if you extracted the therapist out of our situation, would this have ever happened to us? No. Beth never had the thought of going into a counselor's office one day and coming up with this kind of an idea for in a lifetime. She would have never thought of that. Recently, I heard a falsely accused parent, a dad, say, "The day my daughter accused me is the day, as far as I'm concerned, she died. I want nothing to do with her." And I remember those days when those thoughts passed through my mind, the hurt, the anger. But I've chosen a different course. It's like a kidnapping. My daughter's been taken captive. Do I just wash my hands and leave her emotionally and mentally brainwashed? I can't, because I know who she is, and I know who she was. The big brown-eyed little girl with that precious spirit and her tender heart toward God. I remember the memories, the fun, the talks. She's my first baby, my daughter, and she had become my friend. I missed her, and I wanted her back. I'm choosing not to let go, but to reach out and love her back and help her, and yes, forgive.
Thank you, Han. We're approaching that break period, but we had it that perhaps there might be a question or something that you would like clarified, and I'll repeat the question so that everybody could hear. But if there's something that kind of stands out in your thinking or a question of some sort, we really are on question number 6 that we just finished, and we've got I think 14 more to go or something close to that. we want to get to the rest of those as well. But if there's a quick question of some kind, we would be happy to have you ask it. Yes, sir. We will be sharing that in a little bit. The question was, who paid for the education while the daughter was going to college? And I guess I can quickly answer that. We did. At the same time, we were being charged with all of these horrible atrocities. It was a most difficult, impossible moment. But we will be sharing more about that. Yes, sir. Yeah, come on up, Beth.
By way of the counselor, it was set up in our church that the church paid her salary so that we could go for free to her counseling. So by way of my counselor, I didn't actually pay anything directly to her. The church paid her salary to cover those expenses. By way of the psychologist, clinical psychiatrist, or the psychiatrist and the psychiatric hospital bills, those were bills that were given to me to pay.
Yes, sir.
What type of therapy do you feel was received when she was hospitalized and with this other group of therapists? Did they believe the repressed memories, and were they of that?
You mean when I was in the psychiatric hospital, what was their belief? My reason for being admitted was my weight loss. I was dehydrated, hypoglycemic, and was on some, critical levels there by way of even making life. So my purpose in the psychiatric hospital was actually for them to try to get me eating again and drinking again, that kind of thing. I know the nurses that were there and then the psychiatrist that I was seen by, they went 100% along with repressed memory. And the fact that, of course they ask you your history when you come in and explain what had happened. I'd gone into therapy and that kind of thing and what had come out of that, and they were 100% behind that. But my real goal in there was more stabilizing me physically and not so much the psychiatric end of things, although there was some times of group therapy.
I want to just add one little thing to that. Of course, when we filed the lawsuit, all of these records and case notes and everything was turned over to our attorney. And we also have copies of all of those records as well. One of the things that really, really is overwhelming, and it gets back to your question, where are they at in this philosophical issue or in the ideology of age regression therapy or false memory syndrome? But do you know, in every single one of the professional's notes, it actually states, prior to therapy, there were no memories. Memories started after therapy. It is blatantly bold writing in their very case notes. And again, if it were not for the fact that these people, the professional community, those that are a part of this, I think it would have been a flashing red light. It should have been a flag being waved just blatantly. Though it's all in their case notes, nobody picked up that this is a terrible sick therapy going on. And so I think, in answer to your question further, that is where their particular persuasion was with regards to this particular discipline of therapy. Your question?
So is your stance that there are no repressed memories of the old
history? I am not speaking in behalf of all the professional people and just my own personal opinion. I do believe that there is something called repression of memories. There could be something neurologically going on. There could have been an automobile accident, a head injury of some sort, and there will be a repression process. And I think there are those isolated experiences or something that in the natural course of memory will forget. Memory is unreliable. I think one of the studies that Elizabeth Loftus have done is that in an auditorium of 100 students, it was kind of a setup, a mock situation to where the instructor had an individual come in and take something and then run out. All 100 students were asked to put down and write exactly what happened. And within a day or so after that, she had a lineup of 5 individuals that came in, and this 100 students were to identify one of these individuals in the lineup. Do you know those 100 people were evenly split between the five people? And as that was within a few days of the incident that happened. So you see, memory is not as reliable as we might think it is. It's not like a video recording of every little detail. So in conclusion, I personally, our family, and I think the vast majority of the professionals will say, and the scientists and the academic community would say, that those individuals who have, for instance, been in Nazi concentration camp from the time they were 7 to the time they're 17 years old, they are now 40 years old and they don't remember ever being in a Nazi concentration camp. That is absolutely ludicrous. It is absolutely, totally ridiculous. That is not how the memory works. And in that sense, repression is crazy.
I would maybe add to that too. It's like in my case, the fact that this abuse occurred from ages 7 to 14. Now, why in the world or how would it even be possible that you're going to repress those bad things, but I can remember my teachers, where we lived, you know, that now it's a selective repression of memory. And, you know, personally, you know, you go from ages 7 to 14 in selective repression of just that material only, I don't buy it now.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, he asked if I attended any survival groups, and if so, what went on in those sessions. No, I did not participate in any kind of formal survival group setting. However, my counselor had other people that, you know, one of the ladies, she's now probably in her late 30s or 40s, and I would get together and talk with her, but it was on an informal kind of thing.
Anyone else? Yes, sir.
Will there be time after the second session?
For some questions and answers, yes, there will be. Yes. All right. I think you're probably ready for a break. Let's take a break. You've been so gracious. We probably want to begin about 10 after 3, if you kind of plan that, please. Thank you. You're looking at your blue handout. We're going to be jumping right in on number 7. Cher is actually going to combine number 6 and 7, or I mean 7 and 8 together. One of the things that was such a critical time for us was not knowing where our daughters were and trying to sort out life. You see, where do you go from here? We thought about pursuing a legal side of this whole thing. But when you don't have your 3 daughters, how do you go after somebody and you don't even have your children on your side? We went to a lawyer and asked him, because my wife and I were so convinced that these things not only did never happen, but we honestly believed that our daughter was still a virgin. We even wrestled in our own thinking, could possibly our daughter had been violated when she was a little girl, and we never knew it. Now, I don't know how you might feel about that or how you might respond to that, but down deep inside in our gut, we just felt as though that couldn't have happened. Because we happened to believe that if our daughter had been violated, I just would happen to believe that we would somehow know it in our hearts, in our spirit. I think a mom would know if that had happened to her daughter. There's just something that we happen to believe. It was in July when the phone rang. Well, much to our absolute unbelievable, it was Shara on the telephone. You see, we had already come to that place of thinking that we will never see any of our daughters again in this lifetime. And Shara had called. I was so absolutely overwhelmed and excited just to hear her voice. I kind of motioned to Joyce and I pointed to the phone and I mouthed the words, "Shara's on the phone," but I didn't say it out loud. Well, being so absolutely desperate and wanting Shara to talk and having a little bit of conversation, I just was kind of like 6 left feet and kind of falling all over my feet. And I was trying to get out some conversation so that Shara wouldn't immediately hang up the phone. And we may never hear from her again. So I began to talk, and I said, "Well, how are you? I hope every..." And I'm just doing a terrible job at trying to keep this conversation going. And then I was able to finally make some kind of a sense out of my own conversation. I said, "Shira, I said, honestly, your mom and I, we'd just love to get together with you. Maybe we could, I'll tell you what, there's, what about that possibility? We could sit down and just kind of get together. Do you know what I mean?" And there was a pause. And I knew then I had said the wrong thing, and my heart just literally broke. And Shira said, "Well, Dad, I'm off the whole weekend." Wow. That was wonderful. And I didn't know what to say again. I said, "Well, listen, I'll tell you what. Shira, what's the possibility what do you think? Listen, your mom and I, can we come by? We didn't even know where she lived, how to even find her. If you'll let us know, if we could know where you live, could we come by and pick you up, and we'll go to a restaurant. You pick the restaurant. It's on us. We'll take care of everything. Could we come by and catch you?" And then there was a long pause, and I knew it was over. This conversation was finished. And again, another attempt was lost. And Shira then said, she said, "Well, really, Dad? I'd really rather just come home." That moment, heaven came down in our home and in our family. The quickest thing I could do is say, "All right, we'll be there," and we set a time, and she told us where, and I got off the phone last night, blow it. And I got the phone and I told Joyce, I said, "What had just happened?" Heaven came down. And sure enough, we were going to go and pick up our daughter for the first time. And Joyce and I, you can't imagine how long the next 3 hours was, because we set a time to pick her up around 4 o'clock. And when we got there, we were there early. And we found out later that Shira, she was even ready far before the time came. But there were several things, of course, just because we got back together didn't mean that there weren't things to be worked out. Some awesome moments were still in store for us. Shira came home that night, and for the next 9.5 hours, we talked into the wee hours of the morning, and she began to tell us what had happened. And it was during that time period that this whole lie for her began to be dismantled. And I'd like her to come, and we're going to dive in to our second part. And thank you for being here today. And Shira, we love you. You are a precious, precious jewel and a dear, dear daughter. We're so proud of you.
I guess I'm on. Okay. Throughout this whole thing, Lynette and I were never told the entire story. We were never told details. We were told what my parents were accused of, but we were never given details. As time went on and more details came out, parts of the story just weren't fitting together, and it started creating a lot of questions in my mind. And I just had this feeling inside that something's not right, because I grew up in this home too. And then another part of me, I wanted to forgive and go on, and I wanted the healing to happen, and I wanted the family back together. But yet, I couldn't desert Beth, because I knew she wasn't ready to come home, and she didn't want that yet. And I thought one night, I said to myself, heaven help me if I don't go home. Or heaven help me if Beth is right and I go home. And heaven help me if I don't go home and my parents are innocent. And I was so torn inside, and I didn't know what to do. And so I started spending a lot of time just alone, thinking and pondering about what to do, trying to sort out the details, trying to reach back into my own past and remember things. And after hours of this, and for days, weeks, I finally decided that Beth would just have to understand. And regardless of who was right or who was wrong or who did what to whom, I wanted my parents back in my life. And my parents had never done anything to me. And as far as I could remember, my childhood was pretty good. And they had never shown anything to me but love through the contact, like my mom had shared when I did call and I was mean and I was nasty, and she would give me a soft answer, and that wasn't a monster, and that wasn't the person that had been made out to me in my mind. And I was ready for the family to come back together, and I would sit and I would think, you know, I want my dad to walk me down the aisle on my wedding day. And I want my children to have a grandmother. And I resolved to myself that I would be loyal to any cause that I believed in. But yet, for what I felt was right, I would lay down that loyalty that I had towards Beth. And I knew in my heart that I had to do what was right. And so, when me and my dad did get in contact with each other, and I did tell him that, no, I would just rather come home. And I was so scared after I did that, I hung up the phone and I wanted to call him back and tell him, no, it's a mistake. And for the first time in months, my parents knew where I lived. I had given them directions to my place that I was staying at, and I was scared to death. But yet, it was something that I really wanted to do. And, you know, from the moment I walked through that front door with my purple hair and having dipped into drugs and alcohol, and I was a mess. I was a real mess. And they showered me with so much love. And they loved me for who I was, regardless of what I had become or what mess I had made out of myself. And we talked for 9 hours that night. And I spent that night at my parents' house, and it was the best night's sleep I had had in a long time. And I had gone to their house with the intention of forgiving them all the wrongdoings that they had done and going on. And I went to bed that night seeking their forgiveness for ruining their lives and what I had done. And you know, I've heard people through conferences say that my child will never step across my front door unless they ask my forgiveness for what they've done and then admit what they did wrong. And many children are returners before they're ever recanters. And I was. I went home with the intention of giving them forgiveness and going on and realized that I was the one that was wrong. And if my admittance of guilt had been a condition for my parents' love for me, I would have never, ever stepped through that front door. And I ask you to love your children before they come home and not after. When Beth found out that I had gone home, she gave me a call. She said, you know, Shara, I love you, and you will always be my sister. But you've stabbed me in the back, and I'll never ever be able to talk to you or trust you like I used to, and I cannot believe that you've done this to me. And that hurt because I love her and we're very close. And she got off the phone with me and she turned to my sister Lynette, who was living with her, and she said, Lynette, don't ever do to me what Shara's done. I started having secret conversations with Lynette while Beth was at work, and my parents and I went and visited Lynette, and she believed my parents, and I guess you could say came to the other side. And Lynette has a story all her own, and she's not here to be able to share that, but living with Beth, I'm trying to remain neutral is something that I know a lot of perhaps your children are struggling with. And it was easier for me because I could separate myself from that and choose my side, but Lynette couldn't do that. And she did choose her side, but she had to remain neutral for Beth because she was still living with her. And then the four of us worked together to bring Beth home. And we struggled because we're all kind of dominant, as we showed on this trip. All four of us trying to pack a trunk, and my dad would move one suitcase and three more when it's spot. But with four minds working together with ideas, and some people would say no and yes, and my parents were eager to confront Beth, and me and Lynette felt no, Beth's very fragile, you can't do that. And with all four of us given ideas, we worked together to bring her home. And she, like others, was a returner before she was ever a recanter. And she said to me once, "Shara, I know this didn't happen to me, but what about all these pictures in my head? I still see it and I still feel it. How do you get rid of that and heal?" And I'll let her come and share.
Okay, I was the big project. But they lassoed me. They got me in. I want to start out by saying the things I'm about to share, I know I don't have an ABC program here, okay, that if you do these three things, it's going to bring your child home. I know every one of your situations are different, and some things that I'm going to share might not apply. But I'd like to share with you what I learned, what I've done, you know, by sitting down talking with my mom and dad. There were things that they, if they had done them, I would have never come home, or things that they did do that would help me and bring me back. And I just want to share those things, and maybe they can be just guidelines for you. I don't know your son or daughter, you do, but I'd like to share in my experience what helped me. As my mom shared, you know, she looked for those opportunities, both of them really, to love towards me. And the first one came with the Oklahoma City bombing. And there's nothing more comforting on that day, and it's a day I'll never forget, than to hear mom's voice. And she looked for that opportunity, and she pursued that. A couple months after that, again, we didn't talk on the phone after that, nothing like that. I was in Oklahoma City, and they're in Springfield, and the city of Tulsa sits right there in between. And I decided, again, that I was going to show my mother and father that I don't need them in my life, and I'm just doing so much better without them. Little did they know, I wasn't doing all as great as what I said. And so I told my mom, I tell you what, Mom, I'll go shopping with you because we love to shop. And I would meet her at a mall and we could go shopping. And she agreed to that. And there were some things that happened in that first meeting together that I want to share with you. And again, if you would ever get a chance to meet your son or daughter, may these be guidelines, because they really helped me. Number one, the thing that attracted me to even meet with my mom was the neutrality key. Meeting in a mall was a very neutral thing. It was a neutral place. It wasn't a place of confrontation. We had agreed beforehand that we wouldn't even talk or discuss the subject. And when we got together, we talked about the dog and what her latest stunt was, and you know, things she would get into. We talked about nursing. We were both nurses. We were doing a neutral activity like shopping. It was a place of activity. You know, I didn't go to a table and we sat down and stared at each other. That would have been too much. But it was activity. There was noise, commotion going around us. There wasn't pressure for conversation because of those factors. And when we did talk, it was on neutral subjects. That building of a foundation, if you want to call that, helped me so much in the future steps that would come ahead for me. I didn't feel threatened
with my parents. And at that point, it was just my mom. I hadn't seen my dad. Having a neutral place like that, where somebody wasn't dropping me off or that kind of thing, or where they were picking me up, I had control in that if I felt, let's say my mother decided to confront me, I had car keys and I had a car I could leave if I wanted to. That really appealed to me. And I'll tell you why. In therapy and in my course of counseling, I was told how to feel, what to do, when we'll do it, who we're going to say it to, you know, and it was their time schedule, and I'm not feeling angry enough, so we need anger therapy, and those kind of things. The idea that I had control, I could leave this situation if I wanted to, was very appealing to me, that control factor, that if I wanted to say no, I could. And even more important on that part of things is that my mom and dad respected my answers in those early times of getting together. If I said no, they abided by that. I remember one time they came to Oklahoma City to see me, and they had driven to the apartment, and my sister, Shara, came upstairs and where I was living and asked if I would see my mom and dad because they had come to visit. And I said, no, I don't want to see them, and you tell them to leave. And my parents respected that. And you can talk to my dad. That was the last thing he wanted to do. He knew if he could just bust down that door and grab a hold of me and shake me, that it would snap me out of it. But that would have been the worst thing he could have ever done, was to confront me in that kind of manner. It would have driven me from my parents completely. But they respected my answers, and in those early stages of us meeting each other and just seeing each other, the fact that they respected me, I knew that if I said no, they wouldn't cross that line. And I appreciated that. And you know, my mom and dad left and cried the whole way home. They felt like that had been a failure. They had come to see me, and I said no. They had driven 5 hours to get there, and you get back in the car and drive the 5 hours back. And they felt as if that whole thing had been a failure, but they didn't know it till later we had gotten back together. They were getting ready to leave, and I peeked out the window shade, peeked out the blind there, and I saw my mom. Of course, that was the first time I had seen her. And I wanted to run down there and go hug her, because I wanted a hug. You don't go to your place of employment and hug people. You know, you don't hug a fellow coworker. You get that kind of affection from family. And I just wanted to run down there and get a hug from her. I wanted love and affection. But I just, you know, I backed up from the window and no, no, no. And you withdraw yourself, cut off the emotional conflict going on there. And what my mom and dad had seen as a failure was actually a little step, a little chink in that wall. And I would mention that to you just to encourage you in that, you know, there may things you may do. I don't know if it's sent in a letter and it gets sent back to you or those kind of things. But let me just encourage you. You just don't know what's going on in the mind of the accuser when you're doing stuff like that. My mom and dad, like I said, saw that as a failure, but it really was a little step for me. I know when we went shopping in the mall that first time we had gotten together, my mom asked me, she said, can I buy, it was a little bath sponge. She said to me, can I buy that for you? That was really something to me. It kind of struck me, even though I didn't say anything to her at the time. But by her asking me, it did two things. First of all, it left me with the answer and the consequences of my answer in that. Had I said no, I can't walk away and say, well, look at that. She didn't even care about me and didn't even offer to buy me something. Okay? It would have been my own fault if I didn't get something because I said no. If I said yes, it wasn't, oh, look at my mother's feeling guilty and so she's buying me something. It left that answer and the result of whatever my answer was with me. And also, again, it provided, I felt like they were respecting me by asking me if it's okay with me, and they weren't forcing it on me. They let their emotions show through, and I would have to say that was the biggest key factor to getting me turned around. And I'll share the time when I saw my dad. I had been upstairs. I was at my aunt and uncle's house in Tulsa, and I was still living in Oklahoma City, and my parents had gone out to lunch with my aunt and uncle, and they'd come home or come to my aunt and uncle's house. And my mom came upstairs and again asked me, Beth, would you just see your dad? He just wants to make sure that you're okay.
He just wants to see that you're okay. You don't have to talk or anything. He just wants to see you. And at first I said no. I said, Mom, if I see Dad, I'm going to throw up because I still believed it. And just the sight of my father repulsed me to the point that I knew I would vomit if I just saw his face. And they, you know, respected that and backed off. And I sat up there for a little longer. And she kind of asked me again. You know, my father didn't come marching up those stairs, and he's only one floor below me. So finally I agreed, okay, I'll let him see me. And I told my mom, I just want this to be very natural. And it's like, right. It's not a natural thing. And so I went downstairs into the kitchen, and I went over and I was getting a cup of coffee because I wanted to be doing something. And so I'm stirring the coffee, and out of the corner of my eye, I see him coming across the kitchen. And I thought he was coming over to hit me with his fist because I still believed that image of my father. And he walked over, and he just stood next to me, and he just started to cry. It's a tale I won't ever forget. And he said to me, can I say your name? Again, the question. And I just kind of shook my head, and he said my name. He said, Beth, and he just kept saying it. He said, Beth, I haven't said your name in so long because it hurt. And he said, I thought I would never see you again. I thought I'd lost you forever. And he said, thanks for just letting me see you. And then he was crying. He said, am I embarrassing you? He was so thoughtful towards me. And we talked a little bit, and we went our separate ways that day. But, you know, driving home in the car in the quiet, I began to think about that. And my father, a very broken man next to me, just so glad just to see me. It wasn't, how could you have done this to me? What is wrong with you? How could you think I could have done something like that to you? It was nothing like that. It was nothing but love and concern and thankfulness that I just let him see me. That started to change my mind as to who that man was, because the two didn't go together. That broken, loving, forgiving person next to me, just so happy just to say my name and just to see me, didn't match the monster in my head and me seeing him in that condition. And I, you know, you always hear, oh, you know, men shouldn't show their emotion or what have you, but it was one of the biggest turning points for me, was seeing my dad like that. I know in the beginning too it was kept short, and I think that's important. Anytime you in the beginning steps there where you would see a son or daughter, grandson, what have you, that it's kept short. If we had been together day and night and day, that's just too much. It's too much in the beginning for an accuser like me. It was short. I mean, we're talking a few hours, and then we split. We went different ways. They, you know, back to Missouri, and me back to Oklahoma City. That was very good. First of all, you can only have so much neutral conversation to talk about, so it was good in that fact. But keeping it little short, sweet, loving, and neutral were some of the biggest good things they could have done, even though at the time they had no idea what they were doing. I know my mom and dad never gave me an ultimatum. I know Cheryl related to that I was never told you must apologize to me before you can see me or anything like that, before you can talk. They continued to reach out to me first. I know then at that time, a few weeks later, I did go home for the first time. Again, it was kept neutral. We didn't even talk about this subject. And I know my mom and dad, they had many talks together. Should we bring it up? Should we let Beth bring it up? And how should we bring it up? And that kind of thing. But they decided they would let me bring it up. And that was the best thing in reestablishing trust with them and a relationship with them, was they let me bring it up in my own time. However, previously to that, they did make comments which were very helpful for me. Because as I began to realize what had happened and what I had done, or that maybe this isn't true, I had a foundation of love from them that I knew no matter what I told them, it wasn't going to get me thrown out of the house, so to speak. I remember my mom telling me, she said, Beth, she said, I don't even really care what all happened. You know, even if you knew all this was wrong from the very beginning, that doesn't matter to me. I'm just glad to see you. they told me it didn't matter, again, what I would tell them. They loved me. They told me, they made comments, you know, whenever you're ready, we'd love to hear what happened to you. It wasn't, we'd love to hear, you know, how you could have done what you did and who led you down some raunchy road. It was what happened to me. Their sympathy and their compassion for me was very overwhelming for me. And it kept drawing me back to them and to conversation. Again, never any kind of threatening. I never felt like I had some big punishment coming for me or anything like that. I know when I brought up the subject, we ended up talking 11 hours, and I think it was about 11 hours, and even went through McDonald's drive-thru, so we didn't have to stop for dinner in our initial conversations about what had happened. It was helpful for me. My mom and dad said to me, you know, Beth, we think we know what's happened to you and how this came to be. That was good for me in that it allowed me to save face, so to speak, for what had happened. I didn't feel like I was having to explain to my parents how this happened, how I would believe something like this. The fact that they already understood it and they communicated that to me was so helpful. And, you know, it's real painful coming from this end of it. In admitting what happened and telling my mom and dad how this all took place, to tell them to their face what I believed had happened. And the fact that they were able to say to me, we understand, we know, and it's okay, was so helpful for me to be able to open up what happened, to be able to explain to them what happened and allow some of that healing to begin. In those first few times when we did begin to talk about it, my mom and dad never, so to speak, hashed out what had happened to them in front of me. That would have been too much for me. The guilt factor of what had happened to them and the way their life had been, you know, that they're living off savings, that people in the shopping mall back up from them. Had they told me that in the beginning, it would have pushed me away because I couldn't have handled the guilt factor for that. But they saved that stuff to a time where I was ready. And we have sat down and talked about that, those kind of things, and exchanged both ways. But that was a very good thing that they didn't hash out all their hurt and all their pain, although it was important and legitimate. They didn't hash it out in the very beginning for me. They never told me either that it was my duty to clear their name publicly. You know, my parents had been ruined publicly in a town among leaders, among people. And they never said to me, you know, Beth Boyle will be waiting for you to stand on the street corner and announce our non-guilty status, that kind of thing. Again, that kind of a statement to me, that I didn't have to run to their friends and explain what happened, showed me their love was for me and not for what I had done or not done. In fact, I had struggled with how do I call my friends who I told and they took my side, how do I call and explain what had happened? And my mom and dad offered to call them for me. Again, their love for me, that they would take, you know, the embarrassment of trying to call somebody up and explain to them what had happened. They did that, offered to do that for me. It meant the world to me. Here are some things I would maybe share for you. Some of these things my mom and dad did. Some of it's just from talking to other people. The little things, the little times of love, you know, and opportunities that you can show. Ideas for reaching out to an accusing son or daughter. Often I know mail is sent and it gets mailed back to you, or they might throw it away. I know one thing, and that's flowers. Flowers can't be mailed back to the sender. And it's a little card inside, and just three words, we love you. It's going to be something that you read fast. It's not something, it's not a nine-page document that you read the first sentence, find out it's from them, and it goes in the trash. The little three words, we love you, on a card is something you're going to read, you know, just to see who these flowers are from, and it's not something that's sent back. I know my mom, one time, sent me a postcard from the dog. And you know, I would read the postcard from the dog, but I wouldn't read a postcard from her. And even though I knew that
my dog does not write postcards, that it had to be my parents that did that, and wouldn't the therapist have loved to have gotten a hold of that one? Do you know, I'd read the postcard from the dog, and it was just little things, you know, I've been playing, and of course it's from a dog's point of view, and we miss you, and we love you, but you know, I would read that. And I don't know, maybe you've got a pet bird or something like that. If you have the opportunity, if, you know, some people don't know the address, but if those kind of things arise, they did reach out to me. I remember even on a postcard that was maybe sent to, again, it wasn't life's defense of why we didn't do this on the back of that. It was nothing but words of love, and we'd love to have you come home. If you need anything, we're always here, Mom and Dad. Simple, big writing, you know, that I could read it in a glance. It wasn't tiny little letters. All those kind of things were things that were done that did get through. And even though I didn't show that back to them like it meant anything to me, you know, even like I explained, my mom and dad coming down to see me, and they think it's a failure, even though I didn't show it out, it does make a difference, even though you don't admit it or you wouldn't tell anybody. And I've had, you know, somebody ask me, well, you know, we've been told to leave them alone because if you do something, you can push them on the edge or drive them further away from you, that kind of thing. What should we do? And this is just my personal opinion on that subject. If you don't do anything, that is perceived and it is construed by a therapist or whatever that you don't care about your daughter or son, that you could care less that they're not in your lives, and that you love them only based on what they do, and if they don't do nice things to you, you don't want them or you don't love them. And I can guarantee you, as in my own case, when nothing is done, that is how that is perceived. But if something is done, they can't say that you don't care, that they don't want, or that you don't want them in their life. And I believe, or I feel, even in my case, the two major things, you know, that brought me home was, first of all, God. I do feel he worked a miracle in my life and in our family. And then also, it was my mom and dad's love that was the oversounding theme towards me that helped bring me home. And so my personal opinion on that subject is to, yes, you know, not that you send flowers every week. That is too much. But those little things of continued love, that if they are ready and if they want to, you still want them and you still want them in their life. That's the only way, really, to communicate that kind of a thing. And I would encourage you then, from my experience as a mom and dad, to continue showing those expressions of love towards them. Okay, Dad's going to come and wrap up.
Beth, why don't you stay here a second in case... if there's I thought this might even be a good time if there's a few questions or anything from anyone. We're on item number 17 when I start, and I'm going to go from there rapid fire and try to get done in order to catch an airplane. But if you might have a question of Beth or the family, we would invite you to ask now. Yes, sir. All right.
And if sure you want to comment on this, feel free to. You know, I can't give you an answer for yes, go do this or don't do that, okay? But my viewpoint on that, I think a card, we love you, simple and only those three words, you can't get murder out of that. If it's now... you know, if it's something harsh or even just in the neutral category, I could see that. But where if it's love that's being communicated, I know in my case, I wouldn't have run from that.
Well, Shara, could you come up and use the microphone? And while she's coming up, one thing I think for Joyce and I that was an overriding guide, and that is one of the things that Jesus shares in the gospel, where it says, love your enemies, do good to those that despitefully use you. And that I think what Jesus there is really trying to say is that love is not going to necessarily win your enemy. Or is love going to turn around a terrible deed or a hatred of your enemy towards yourself? I believe what he's saying there in the Gospels is that love, if that won't work, nothing will. But if anything will, that will. And I think that was the motivator that Joyce and I were trying to follow, and that's the message I think that when you do reach out, and honey, if you have a comment too, but that has got to be the basis. Sharon?
Yeah, I think I would err in the side of love. Well, my dad did go through different channels to find out my phone number, and I wasn't very pleased about it, and it really scared me because I knew he could then find out where I lived. The fact that he didn't do that, he only asked for my phone number, was a thing for me, but that's a different case. I was scared that they were going to come for me, but I was waiting for it. I was actually ready for it. I wanted them to do it. And I can't think that it's a bad thing to contact them if you know where they are. And yeah, I was scared, but yeah, like Beth said, if it's a message of love, you can't deny that.
I think if you're addressing a security factor, like if they don't know you know where they live, you don't want to send a card to where they live, because you're right, they'll move someplace else. We had that instance where Beth and Lynette moved, didn't want us to know where they lived. We respected that. What we did is work through a third party, which was Shara. Shara knew where they lived, but they didn't want us to know. So we didn't ask to know where they lived. All we did is said, Shara, we want to send the girls a plant for moving into their new house. So you send the plant, here's the money. So then, and at that point, Shara was in contact with them, and that was acceptable. And the first thing Beth did was got all upset because they know where we are. And Shara said, no, they gave me the money. I went to the florist, I sent it. So if it's a security factor, work through another person who knows where they are, but don't violate what they don't want you to know.
Yes, ma'am. What happened? The question was, what happened to the therapist? And nothing has happened. To the best of our knowledge, she would be still counseling.
Yeah, and I would just have to go off my experience there. You know, I've not gone through all her appointment books, that kind of thing. So this would be my opinion. While I was there, yes, she was full-time. And there are people that I talked to, other people she was seeing, that we would get together and talk, and they were expressing the same experience as me, and that is, until therapy, and then they started remembering these kind of things. So I have talked with other people she has seen in regards to the same kind of experience. That's probably something you would have to ask her. I would say I was told that sexual abuse and the past of that was one of her specialties.
Mm. Yes, sir.
Mm.
The question is, how did you make it through in relationship with your God and not abandoning God? And I'd like to try to tackle that one on question number 18. Okay? Thank you. All right. Let's move ahead. Thank you, ladies. One of the questions that's before you, if I cannot forgive my child, should I try to get the family back together? And again, as Beth has already stated, we don't feel as though we have all the answers. A lot of what we're sharing is just from our own personal experience and what we've learned along the way, and that's really what we're sharing. And if you find it helpful, then it's worth every mile of our trip, tenfold. And that's our blessing. As a matter of fact, this is not something that a mom and dad is compelling, and that is that we are here. But we are here as a family, and that each of the daughters are here because they want to be here, and they are sharing today because they really, really want to. We're into this together, and it's a team. We have a lot of fun. And you tell me, what family do you know that can fly all over the United States having the kind of fun that we have? And of course, there is the other side. But in all honesty, it is like a therapy for us. It is like a healing process, just knowing from what you have told us. Even over the break, your words have been so encouraging, and it just does marvelous things for our own personal healing. And we thank you for loving us. And I just sense in my heart, we love all of you. The question is, should I try to put my family back together if I indeed cannot forgive? And I really feel that for any parent, the answer of that is really no. You should not try to put your family back together if you cannot forgive them. I would really encourage you to seek and find and resolve the issue of forgiveness before you even attempt to reach out to your children. I would like to say that in a balanced fashion. That means after 5 years, I still haven't been able to hurdle that one, so therefore I've cut off all contact. No, I think the scripture says that where your treasure is, there your heart is also. Set your affections on things above and not on things of this earth. So by you reaching out and placing your treasure there, your heart has a way of following. So there are some really significant principles that I think are there that we can follow, and it'll help us. So in the process of you trying to deal with the forgiveness thing, do keep reaching out. Obviously, you're probably not having direct contact or direct communication of any sort anyway, which we weren't, as we were trying to work through that horrible hurricane, that terrible storm. But I really want to encourage you, before you actually would make the first meeting, that you've got to have that thing resolved, and it's got to have been worked out, or I think it could end in a terrible disaster. The next thing, how do you deal with the stress of these horrible allegations? And that's kind of getting back to this gentleman's question here. The loss of your job, your reputation, and your name. The loss of your respect in your community and before your church and even your denomination. To be all honest with you, it almost put my wife and I completely to the place of insanity. I think I've already mentioned the fact that we had put our home up for sale and we wanted to move to any place that was a remote part on the face of the earth and live in obscurity for the rest of our lives. You see, when you wake up in the morning and nothing has changed and there's no way, there's no artificial way to drown out any of this stuff, it haunts you. It seeks you out. I'd like to share 11 or 12 or 13 things, and I'm watching my watch up here, which is really my worst enemy and your best friend, folks, to try to share with you some of the things. One thing, I could not trust my mind. I could not allow my mind to be alone by itself. When I was alone at home, I had music playing, Christian music, something of that kind of sort. And it was constantly playing. It's a good thing we weren't in an apartment building because I would have been, probably, we would have been kicked out because it was playing so loud. You see, I played it so loud so I could drown out my thoughts. I did not trust my mind to be left alone. As a Christian, I sought fasting and prayer. We sought another church and sought out another pastor. I really happen to believe that you have to have a home church and that kind of a support team, and you've got to have a pastor. We didn't have any friends, but the few that we had, thank God for a few. They enabled us to come over and bleed on them at times, and they kept propping us up. There were times where I could not read the Bible. I remember some of the things that I would read out of the Bible, and it was such a blatant, screaming contradiction to me. How God will provide and how He protects and how He will go before you, and I could see none of those things. There were times where Joyce and I would rent a video or go to a movie or put together a puzzle just for distraction, something to help our sanity. We saw some videos like Gandhi. You might know the one of Rudy, the baseball or the football player at Notre Dame, and deal with some of those true life situations and seeing other people and understanding some of their hurdles and hardships. We kind of rub shoulders with some of those individuals that I think are internationally renowned that enabled us to sometimes get enough strength to make it another 24 hours. We took money out of our savings, of which we did not have, but we did it anyway. And we went on a trip to Florida. And we just went out there along the East Coast and West Coast and walked on the shoreline and felt the majesticness of that ocean and the waves to try to give us a fresh perspective and a little more ability to cope with our insanity that we were living in. One of the things we couldn't have done, and that is go and watch the movie like The Father of the Bride. It would have killed us. There were a number of church functions that we absolutely could not attend and didn't. And thank God for friends that would understand. Joyce could not go to a baby shower. It paralyzed us to think of going to a wedding. It was beyond comprehension to do something like that. I remember on Mother's Day, Joyce working in the hospital you see every other weekend. I'm unemployed. I couldn't get myself to go to church. I could not bear it. I think I would have lost everything. So I decided I would stay home and work in my garage. You see, we had moved to a brand new home. And I decided that for the day I would sort the screws and the nails, all of which that exist in my garage. I'd almost like to challenge any one of you men. I bet you I got a finer looking set of screws and nails that are all sorted than any of you that are sitting here. We would read books. If you've ever read Frank Peretti's book, This Present Darkness, it's a must for you. It really helped us. If you're keeping track, I don't know whether I'm on number 11 or number 2, whichever one. Another thing, I want to encourage you to allow yourself to hurt and allow yourself to cry. One job that I did get, and only lasted for 30 days, it was temporary, was I was able to work for the postal system as a fill-in. I remember being a mail carrier and taking the mail from house to house. It was storming down rain on some occasions, and I'm telling you, every step I took, and there were thoughts in my mind. As I walked along these fast-moving highways, either returning back to my vehicle or delivering mail, but I knew I was within 18 inches of relieving myself of this agony and this insanity. And there were many a time when I walked by beside that traffic, it entered my mind, it would make a whole lot more sense to cross over those 18 inches. There were times where I was delivering mail and I cried the entire 10 miles on that route that I carried the mail. And I'm telling you, I just begged God, God, please don't let anybody come to the door. What are they going to think? They see their mailman bawling his eyes out. But it hurt so bad to think of losing our three daughters. One Sunday night in our church, and as our tradition is, many times people are invited to come to the front and kneel and pray if there's a problem, a difficulty, and different ones will pray for each other. There had to be 200 or 300 people down at the front of the church that particular night, and I was just one of them, broken, devastated. Nothing more than a pile of sawdust. There were so many people down front, there was no place to kneel and pray, and I found a pew about three rows back, and I found my way into the pew, and I knelt down, and I was just so broken, so devastated. Thank God for a pastor. I didn't know this, but I was told later that our pastor saw me praying back there. He wanted to come and pray with me. I didn't know this, but I was again told later that my pastor got up and walked down, and he climbed on top of that pew, and he walked on top of the pews to get back there to me, and he knelt down beside me, and he put his cheek against my cheek, and he wept with me. We would have never made it if God had not touched our lives in such a way. I want to thank the Lord for people like the Foundation, False Memory Syndrome Foundation. They had a significant part and a major part in us understanding all of this that ever happened to us. We knew nothing when this happened. Another thing I want to encourage you to do, and there was a time I could not do this myself, and that is to be able to continue to laugh. One of the things that I think is a hallmark of our family and our life and our ministry is, and if I had an epitaph or if you were going to put something on my tombstone, one of the things that would mean so much to me is that even my daughters would be able to remember me as a person who knew how to laugh. But in the midst of this horrible Holocaust, we couldn't laugh anymore. I honestly thought that I would never laugh anymore for the balance of my entire life. But thank God for people, for those friends, and for those who have gone before us, that have reached out to us and helped put this family back together. And honestly, it wasn't until we came back together that I have been able to laugh again. But that is a highlight in our time together, and we do have great times of laughter. Last night at the Govans, Beth and Cher in their bedroom, and Joyce and I left our room, and in the dark, they had some family out there in the living room, and you were having a big time laughing and carrying on. Just like our family. Joyce and I went in and sat on their bed, and we were reminiscing over some of the things that had just occurred over this trip and all, and honestly, we had the most hilarious time laughing. If you can possibly continue to laugh. I'd like to move to another item, and that is, how does a husband and wife help each other cope during such a difficult time? There's three things I'd like to share with you. Number one, give each other room. You see, I think we're all probably very different. You're different than your mate, and your mate, you. And every one of us deal with this thing differently. Every one of us respond differently. And the first thing I really want to encourage you is to give each other room. Space. Allow yourself to deal with it differently. One of the things when the girls were gone and we didn't know if we'd ever see them again in our lifetime was because of the new home that we were moving into and all. And again, we don't have the finances for any of the above. But Joyce had said to me, and she was the only one employed working as a nurse and I'm unemployed, but one thing that she said to me, honey, I would like to finish the guest room. And that was a very difficult moment for me. You see, she said to me, honey, I want to have a room ready so when the girls come home, they have a place to stay. And the time that she said that, it would have been an absolute impossibility and one of the most ridiculous thoughts because it'll never happen. But down in deep, as much as we couldn't afford it, but as much as I knew it meant the world and it was as though it was the thing that would help Joyce make it through. It was one of the things that would enable her to just hold on to a little bit of hope. I agreed and I said, honey, whatever it takes, I want you to go out and decorate that room and put all the extras in it. you know, the shams and the this and the that. I don't even know what some of those things are called. I'm lucky to even remember that one. But she fully furnished that room so that in the event, but it was her hope, that someday when the girls come home, they'll have a place to stay. It was a horrific thing when Cheryl was in school, and of course you know what has happened to us. I'm unemployed. And we're writing out a check for her college, of which you know what happened to that anyway, but to the tune of $550 a month to keep her in college. And again, we're unemployed, and the only place where that money came from was from our savings account. It was so difficult, I could not, absolutely could not write that check. But I knew it was the right thing to do, and Joyce felt we should do it. At least she had a place to stay. And I agreed to go along with it, but I couldn't write the check. And every time that month came around, I couldn't do it, and I handed the checkbook to Joyce. I knew it was the right thing to do, but there was something down inside. It hurt so bad, I couldn't write the check. So Joyce went ahead and wrote the check and signed the name. She mailed it. And if that gives you a little bit of an insight or an idea, you've got to give each other room to deal with it differently and handle it differently. Otherwise, I'm not so sure you'll make it. You see, each of us are so different. And Joyce and I had already agreed that one thing we would do for each other is because that's all that we had was each other. And she agreed that she would take care of herself for her and take care of herself for me. And I agreed to take care of myself for her. And that was an awfully important thing, that each other is all we had, and we would take care of the one in behalf of the other. A third thing is to continue to be loving to each other and to be thoughtful. Joyce knows that I like a clean house, and she would make sure the house was always tidy and put in order and things. And I knew certain things about her, and I would also try to do those things and try to accommodate. Moving on, how do you handle the stress of each other's personality differences? That is another matter. I think when you are single, typically your closest friends are a lot like you, but when you get married, you typically marry somebody that is not like you. At least that was in our case. The first thing is that we had a good marriage to begin with. If we hadn't, I'm not sure if we would have made it. Another, you want to pray and read the Bible and spend those kinds of times together, though at times they're very difficult. We were committed to each other, and we had determined that we were going to go through life with each other, and divorce was not an option. And as my dad has said to me, Tom, you are one of the most blessed men on the face of the earth because your wife stood with you and beside you and didn't abandon you when all three of your daughters were saying these things. And I happen to agree with him. She is one remarkable lady. There were times when Joyce felt that I was wrong in decisions that I had made or things that I was doing. And there were times that I thought she was wrong. And now when we look back on all of this, in retrospect, we find out that indeed I was right most all of the time, and that she really was wrong. There's no truth to that, folks. It's just that I've waited all day to say it. Oh my, both of our personalities are so different. There were times where the strongness and the strength of me was needed. When it came with dealing with the state leadership and our denominational leadership, but I think you've already heard today that it was the tenderness and the kindness and the compassion and softness of a mom that continued to reach out to our daughters. I believe it was mom that brought our daughters home. There are some other things that I'd like to share there, but time is just simply fleeting. I have to move on. Some of the cautions to keep from being too aggressive or doing too much to get the accuser to return. Cheryl and Beth have both mentioned this. Some of the things that we didn't know, but that is, if we had been aggressive and had gone up and stormed in on Beth, and it really, really hurt, enormously it hurt. You see, the day I was accused, it was February 2nd, which happens to be my birthday, when all of this horrible cesspool unleashed itself on us. When we went to Oklahoma City to see Beth, we drove those 5.5 hours down there, and it happened. This was not planned. It just happened this way. You see, it was the day for us to see Beth. It was her mom's birthday, July the 10th, and she refused to see us. I know if I were not fasting, I could not have borne it. I don't know what I would have done, but I know what I would have done, a terrible, foolish thing. The reason why I would have been so foolish is because I know I would have been assertive or aggressive or something of that sort, and the problem would have been all of what I had just done would have proven in Beth's thinking that everything the therapist has said about these parents is absolutely 100% true. But God in His mercy kept His hand upon us, and we didn't do something foolish, so that when we did leave, and I hope you picked it up, it put a kink in Beth's thinking. Because when we left and didn't make a scene, it got her to thinking that the monster that the therapist has made her parents out to be is not the monster. We aren't that at all. And through these various experiences and moments, I believe what happened in Beth's thinking was that it began to dismantle the lie that the therapist had created in her thinking and in her mind. And when she did part from us, of which we didn't know that any of this was going on, it began to work in her thinking and in her heart and saying, wait a minute. But can you see how it would have worked to our disadvantage if we had been other than what it happened? Because it simply would have reinforced that everything the therapist had said was indeed true, when in actuality it was a lie. We didn't know that those things were happening. If only you might, be able to grab a hold of that idea, avoid being confrontational, avoid being forceful, and if there is a meeting agreed upon, make sure that you don't bring it up. When Shara came home, we didn't know what to do. We thought we were the biggest hypocrites on this side of the Mississippi and the other side as well. But we never brought up the subject. We let Shara bring it up, you see, in their good time when they're ready to deal with it. We didn't know what we were doing, if we were even doing things right. But I'll say this. I don't know whether that's the right thing for you, but at least it worked for us. One thing, and then I must close. Or both Pam Fry and us all will miss our airplanes, folks. One of the things is that a person that many times when this has happened, they become a returner before a retractor. Just tuck that away. I learned that from the foundation, folks. And in closing, and in order for us to make that plain, perhaps we might go ahead and scoot. I'd like to just share with you the following few little closing thoughts. One thing that I believe you could take with us, and that is God knows and understands what we as a parent are going through. You see, God, who is often in Scripture called our Father, He knows what it's like to have a wayward son and a child who rejects Him, or a disobedient son or daughter, doesn't He? I raise the question, what did God ever do wrong to make the devil go bad? The truth of it is, nothing. And no, we were not perfect parents, but the truth of it is, guilty of this, never. I believe, too, that Jesus also knows what it's like to go through this as a parent, because He, too, experienced rejection and to be falsely accused and to be scorned, have the loss of a reputation and the damage to His name disgraced and despised. Joyce read this without me knowing it, and I, too, went to the Book of Lamentations. And do you know the same verses that she shared are the same ones that I'm about to share with you? Neither one of us knew the other had selected these verses. Lamentations 16, chapter 1. This is why I weep and my eyes overflow with tears. No one is near to comfort me, no one to restore my soul. My children are destitute because the enemy has prevailed. Those I cared for and reared, my enemy has destroyed. So what do we do in chapter 2:19? Pour out our hearts like water in the presence of the Lord, and lift up your hands to him for the lives of your children. The answer, Psalm 34:18. The Lord is close to the brokenhearted, and he saves those of a crushed spirit. A little boy was told by his daddy to reach in the candy jar, and whatever candy he could get, and as much as he could get in the palm of his hand, he could have it all. And the boy just kind of looked at the candy jar, and he didn't make any response. And the dad said, well, why don't you do it? Everything your hand can reach into the candy jar and pick out, you can keep, and it's all yours to have. It's all of it. And he didn't do anything. And he says, well, son, why won't you do it? And the little guy looked up at his dad and says, Daddy, I would like you to do it instead. And I think you know what he was getting at. His dad said, well, why, son? And he said, because your hand is bigger. I am convinced that if there was something you could do for the sake of your son or your daughter and bring the repairing and the putting back together what is broken, you would have already done it. I dare say that you're here this morning, and whatever is within the power of your hands and your capability, you have already done it. I also rather think that there comes another hand, and that is our Heavenly Father's hand. For only he can reach into this life and put it back together. There comes a time when, after we've done everything we can do, you tie a knot and hang on. I understand the difference between an athlete and an amateur is simply this, and I consider myself an amateur. When they begin to do a physical workout, an amateur, when the pain begins to happen and an ache in their side, they stop and they quit. But for a real pro athlete, when the pain begins to rack in their body from a workout, that's when they really just get started. And I believe I am looking today at a delegation of athletes. I happen to believe that you, as a parent that has gone through such a horrific tragedy, you wouldn't be here today if, when the pain began, you quit. But you're here today, I believe, because when the pain began to rack through your body, you proved the kind of stuff that you're really made out of. And you demonstrated the depth of your love and how much you really care. And I want you to know, my heart goes out to you, and I honor you today as those that are stalwart, that are good parents, and guilty of this, never. I would like to encourage you today from the bottom of my heart, from all of us, our family. If we could but encourage you to, number one, don't quit on God. Keep reaching out to him. Don't quit on your children. Keep reaching out to him. And don't quit on each other. Keep reaching out to one another. Somebody said to me, Tom, when do you think that you will maybe quit doing what you're doing? And I want you to know that we are never going to stop until we have the confidence that every son and daughter has come home. I hope deeply for this for you, that you will remember these three words: never give up. Never give up. Never give up. The last chapter isn't written yet. I want to thank you for coming. And if you would permit me, Let's close in a word of prayer. Father, I thank you today for this opportunity that has been extended to us. Lord, it is you that reached down when we were unrecognizable, that we had been thrown on the trash heap of an ash hill. Lord, you didn't forsake us. And I know, Lord, today that the heartache that is represented in this room, that you, in your mercy and in your grace, our prayer today is, continue to work in the lives of our young people, our sons, and in the many cases, our daughters. Lord, this lie that they have believed by your Holy Spirit, I ask you now that you would work in their life, continue to work in their life, and bring, Lord, the truth back to their understanding. Bring them back to the place of knowing things from and what were true memories and true experiences and the real true mom and dad that they really had. Thank you, Lord, for our time together. And perhaps in a very short bit of time, we're going to see you divinely intervene and, Lord, bring together what had been broken and mend what, Lord, has fallen apart and put back together what has been laid in disarray. I ask you, Lord, to do this in behalf of these parents, in behalf of these families. Lord, because you're the one that came up with the idea of family in the first place. And Lord, your blessing is upon family. In Jesus' name I ask these things. And all that that name stands for, and all that that name represents, I ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. We love you and thank you for being here.